Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Decade after decade, our lives and the systems we use to function in everyday life have become ever more complex. Every week, our news gives us glaring examples of how mistakes in these complex systems, little flubs, little oversights, can blossom into massive failures. Train derailments, bankruptcies, oil spills, medical errors, most recently data breaches in the news. My guest this hour reveals in a new book the surprising ways in which these occurrences of modern life are connected and how to prevent these sort of breakdowns. The title of the book, Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. Chris Clearfield joins me. He's an author along with Andras Tilsik of the book. Chris Clearfield, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
I want to mention here, you're a former derivatives trader, also a licensed pilot. I think that will fit into our conversation a little bit later, but I just wanted to throw that out there from the start. Start by talking about, I think you term it the paradox of progress in your book. We feel it. Our systems have become ever more capable, more complex, less forgiving. Talk about that trend.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, as we look at all of these systems and we talk about these failures in the book, one thing kind of struck us over and over again, which was that these systems that we have around us, they give us tremendous capabilities. And, you know, we're not going to turn back the clock. We're not going to kind of throw them out. And so what the real challenge is today is to figure out how we manage them. And I think you put it beautifully in the intro. You know, we're dealing with a world now where we have these small failures that can kind of snowball and really create these huge problems. One example that I think will resonate with it basically everybody is, you know, if you've we've seen example after example of airlines that have their whole fleets of planes grounded, not because there's a problem with the plane or the pilots aren't there, but because there's a problem with their reservation system or the computer that's supposed to dispatch it. You know, somebody's pulled the cord out in a data center, and hundreds of thousands of people have gotten stranded. And so that's kind of an example of what we see over and over again, that these systems have fundamentally changed, but our way of dealing with them has not caught up yet.
Right. I mean, and also even more grave consequences you recount in the book, the crash of the ValueJet flight that crashed into the Everglades a few years ago. Tell us a little bit of the story behind that.
Yeah, that was really a landmark accident in aviation. You know, it was some cargo was loaded onto the plane. There were oxygen generators, basically, that, you know, themselves were taken out of another plane for some routine maintenance, and they weren't secured properly. And part of why they weren't secured properly is because the instructions to secure them were so complex, and they had maintenance people who were working on it who maybe weren't quite careful enough, but also, they had lots of other things that they were working on. And so this really dangerous cargo kind of gets put in cardboard boxes and sort of lost in the shuffle until it gets loaded onto this plane. After takeoff ignites, and tragically, the flight is lost. And I think what that really was kind of a wake-up call for the whole aviation industry and for regulators, too, who sort of realized that, you know, this wasn't something that they could fix from the top down. This was something where nobody, you know, wrote down on a piece of paper, hey, one of the risks is that we're going to lose track of this cargo and it's going to be loaded up into an airplane and you know, these tragic consequences are going to happen. What they realized is that they needed to start paying attention to the signals of failure that their systems were giving them in order to prevent these kind of chain of accidents.
If you'd like to join our conversation with Chris Clearfield, co-author of Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail, What We Can Do About It, 1-866-780-9100, river to river@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go into social media, into our electronic digital age here with this theme. Data breaches have been in the news a lot lately. Chris, tell us how the increasing complexity of our electronic and social media fits into your theme, your research here.
Well, I think, you know, the recent example of what's been going on with the privacy questions at Facebook are just kind of a pretty textbook example of this. You know, I think if you had asked Facebook even a couple of weeks ago, you know, could a sort of rogue academic, you know, bring down and take the attention of a significant part of your company and sort of, impede the trust that you have with your users? I don't think they would have seen that as a primary risk, and yet we see that relatively small failure of an academic misappropriating the data, kind of coupled with Facebook not really having the protections that they needed to have in place. I mean, that's led to these huge consequences. 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have all of our data in one centralized place that was vulnerable in this way. So it really is an example of how this kind of web of connectivity and really also the difficulty in understanding what is going on for, Facebook, who's managing this huge platform, it's led to this big problem, and it's led to this big meltdown.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at the accelerating pace of our digital age and how we're going by leaps and bounds into ever more complex systems and artificial intelligence, the first beginnings of it with Google Home and Alexa in many of our homes now, this is a problem that will stay with us forever, as far as we can see, right?
I think that's right, and I think as consumers, we have started to, our attitude has started to change and has started to catch up. And we've started to realize that, there is a cost to inviting these devices into our homes. There is a cost in terms of complexity. But the aspect of this that really worries me more from a consumer perspective is there are these times where we actually don't even get to make the choice. And I think a great example of that is in our cars. Our cars are now all computer controlled, and a lot of them are connected to the internet. I have a late model Subaru, and I can look up stock prices on my dashboard. And I mean, frankly, that doesn't make any sense, And what that does, what kind of adding that capability does, is it means that my car is connected to the internet. And we saw a couple of years ago that two security researchers who were hackers, but they were kind of good guys. They were doing it for research purposes. They figured out how to disable the transmission and kind of mess with a Jeep Cherokee through its cellular connection while it was driving down the highway. And Chrysler, did a big recall, fixed the software. But, I mean, the fact that that's even a possibility, I think that's troubling.
I think it was in the New York Times today I saw the story of a man who discovered, I think he was in Ireland, but discovered that just his use of Google and leaving it on all the default settings, he could get a map of where he was exactly going back months across Ireland, how long he was there, when he left, from every bit of data tracing him. And as you said, default, we really don't know how we're being tracked here. Let's talk a little bit about what you talk about in the second part of your book, Chris, prevention. There are some tools and steps organizations and individuals can take to prevent these breakdowns. What can you say?
Well, I think ultimately we think that Meltdown is actually a deeply optimistic book, and much of what we write about is focused on prevention. Or kind of dealing with this complexity, changing our perspective. And the good news, I'll say, is that, because there are these common elements in how these failures happen, that also means that there is a common set of solutions. And one of the solutions is to really obsess about failure, to kind of think obsessively about these small errors before they become big ones. And I'll give you an example of that. We have a story in the book of a nurse who has in a hospital with two patients with similar last names in the same room. And she almost mixes up the medication for these patients. They're actually taking medicine that also has pretty similar names. But she catches her mistake, and she doesn't give the wrong medication. But she does more than just catch her mistake. She also talks with her colleagues about it. She tells them about it, so they're not going to make the mistake. And in fact, they separate the patients, so they're no longer in the same room. So it's much the confusion is much less likely to happen. And then because this almost this near miss is shared so widely in the hospital actually puts into place a safeguard to make it so patients with similar last names won't be put in the same room. So, you know, this is just a great example of how we can actually do better. We're never going to be able to predict all of the failures that these systems can make ahead of time, but what we can do is we can learn from these small failures as they happen to prevent the bigger ones.
Mm-hmm. What else have we talked about as far as commonalities that whatever massive failures you're talking about, oil spills, data breaches, or something happening in a hospital, as you just described, what are the things they all have in common, you and your co-author identified?
Yeah, so when we dig down past the headlines, what we see is that the systems that we're talking about, they have really two things in common. They're complex. So they look a lot like an elaborate web with a lot of different connections between different parts. And they're also complex in the way that, you know, it's hard to understand what's going on inside the system. You can't always, there's not a lot of transparency. You can't send somebody in to figure it out, or what's going on is, you know, happening deep within computer code or an algorithm. And the other property that these systems share is they're what's called tightly coupled. And see, that sounds like a kind of a fancy engineering term, but basically what it means is there's not a lot of slack. There's not a lot of opportunity to put the genie back in the bottle. Once something goes wrong, it's hard to prevent it from escalating and from going even more wrong. And so, you know, with this commonality, these systems are complex and tightly coupled. That's what puts them in the danger zone. That's what puts them in this kind of area where these meltdowns are more likely. And what we see is that over the last two or three decades, so many more systems have moved into this danger zone.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting in your book how you describe how ugly systems make us safer. Give us an example of an ugly system that makes us safer.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the one that sort of was the most striking was the mix-up at the Academy Awards last year. The, you know, Best Picture Oscar was initially announced for the wrong film, and there were loads of things that led to that that meltdown, which, you know, obviously didn't cost any lives, but was pretty embarrassing for the organizations involved. But one of the things that led to the meltdown was the fact that the envelopes had this very, you know, elegant gold lettering on them, you know, really subtle, kind of a beautiful design, but not a transparent one. And so when a presenter was given the wrong envelope, it was hard for him to catch that mistake, and it was hard for people to see that happened really until it was too late. You know, fortunately, the people involved have learned their lesson. The envelopes this year are pretty ugly, frankly. I mean, they have, you know, they're black and white. There's none of this elegant gold lettering. And they have, you know, the category name on the envelope in big text, you know, so that even if you're in the audience, you could see Best Picture. You know, you can pretty easily tell. And that's really a great example of using kind of transparency, or I would say, maybe emphasizing the power of transparency over elegance. And that's something that we need to be thinking about more and more in our systems.
Let's go back to a little bit about how you got into writing about this along with your co-author. I mentioned you were a former derivatives trader, also a pilot. So these pursuits sparked you to explore massive failures. In fact, you experienced the 2008 financial crisis as a derivatives trader.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And obviously, you know, that had widespread impacts for everybody. And so as I was, you know, watching organizations struggle, watching, you know, banks and kind of the industry and society more broadly struggle with the financial crisis, I was also kind of digging, I was starting to learn to be a pilot. And so I was digging into understanding how flight crews, how aviation, how the industry more broadly learns to deal with what is really actually a similar kind of uncertainty. And what I saw was that many people in finance were struggling when aviation had actually figured out how to learn from the systems in a way that finance really is still working on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a couple years after the financial crisis, BP had their big Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And as I started to look into that accident, what I realized was that it was actually exactly the same kind of thing, the same kind of small failures. And so realizing that this was something that cut across industries, and I think more importantly that there was lessons we could all draw from this, that was a big part of the impetus to write the book.
Mm-hmm. One of the areas, we've got about 5 minutes left with Chris Clearfield, Meltdown, the title of his book, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. You talk about discussions, meetings. A lot of us sit through meetings, have discussions. How can the conduct of a discussion or the way a meeting is led lead to avoiding failures?
Yeah, there's some really fascinating research just about, you know, the kind of a simple way you can start a meeting to get more information before your team, you make a decision. So if you're leading a meeting, you should start it by saying, I think the most important thing in this meeting is that we get a chance to hear everybody's perspective. Now, what do you all think should be done? And just by starting the meeting that way, instead of, you know, the kind of, I think, classical way of starting a meeting is by, as a manager, you know, sharing your idea and driving people towards a solution. If instead you just reconfigure that a little bit and say, the most important thing is to hear everybody's perspective, what do you all think should be done? You actually get tremendously more ideas about what you should do, how you should manage your system. And actually, it turns out that this is a piece of research that slots into this kind of bigger, really fascinating area of research that actually shows that speaking up and dissent can be taught. You know, these aren't innate things. These aren't things that are kind of these deep cultural things. There's an aspect of that. But actually, there's examples of people who very deliberately teach managers to listen to these kind of voices of concern and therefore enable people to speak up and share them.
Mm-hmm. Diversity, and that comes with dissent. You have a diversity of opinions, and you write about how that is a safeguard for failure. Explain that a little more.
Yeah, that was one of the most surprising pieces of research that we came across while working on the book. It's that diversity, and what we mean by that is we mean surface-level diversity, so, you know, kind of race and gender and ethnicity, but we also mean diversity in professional backgrounds. And what diversity does is it really makes everybody in a group more skeptical. So it makes us less likely to play into groupthink, and it means that we are more likely as a group to question these kind of, you know, these sort of underlying truths or underlying assumptions that may turn out not to be true.
Mm.
One example of research is looking at community banks during the financial crisis and seeing how they failed. And it turns out having more bankers on the board of a community bank makes that bank more likely to fail. And that's a pretty surprising result. You know, you think that more bankers should be good at managing a bank, but having other people, doctors, lawyers, nurses, public health people or things like that, really broadens the decision-making and makes it so people start by saying, hey, I don't understand. You're going to have to explain this more. And right. That gives us the ability to dissent and to question.
Right. And to follow along with that, you write about how fewer experts, and I don't know if this is across different fields, but fewer experts can be better at managing risk rather than a greater number of experts.
Yeah, exactly. You need some expertise, right? You need somebody who understands what is going on and how things work. But it turns out that having too many experts means exactly that, means that you end up in this little bubble where people aren't willing to say, I don't understand, and question the decision.
Mm-hmm. I like your description of, well, we know postmortems, right? Postmortems on all kinds of things, bodies and so forth, things that go wrong. But you talk about the pre-mortem technique. Explain how that can be used in decision-making.
Yeah, this is really great research done by a psychologist named Gary Klein. And what he realizes is that you know, as humans, we have this great ability. We are just natural storytellers. And so what we can do is we can set up our decisions so they look a lot more like a story. So if we're going to make a big decision, say taking a job at a new company or maybe even in a new city, one of the things we can do is we can say, okay, let's imagine that I take this job and a year has passed. It's a year from now. And it turns out that this was a huge mistake, that taking this job was a really bad decision. I really don't like it. I'm not happy. I'm not happy we moved. Then, okay, now we've assumed failure. Now let's come up with stories about why this failure happened. And just by doing this ahead of time, what the research shows is that we can generate stories that are both kind of more wide-ranging and more specific, and we can understand what the specific ways that this might be a bad decision are. And that doesn't mean we're going to make a different decision necessarily, but what it does do is it gives us the ability to anticipate some of these failures and actually be able to deal with them and be able to get ahead of them before they can happen.
Right, and it seems like a great idea to reduce anxiety because you're naming the monster in the horror movie, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's an example that it's one of the examples in the book that I think we were surprised at because how applicable it is to our personal lives. You know, one of the other things we looked at was how organizations manage crises. So, you know, how emergency room doctors or SWAT teams or firefighters deal with these kind of crisis situations. And as we were doing that research, I started to look at my own life and realize that, you know, our morning routine of my getting my five-year-old ready for preschool, that actually looked a lot like a crisis. And so we were able to take some of that research and changed how we do things in our family. So we now have short 5-minute meetings on the weekend where we just say, okay, how did things go last week? What went well? What didn't go well? And what are we going to try next week? And it's just an example of being able to learn from our system.
Okay.
So we can deal with that.
Chris Clearfield, thank you so much for joining us. We'll all have lessons to take back to our families and our places of work. Thanks so much for being with us. Chris Clearfield, Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon with help from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.